morning. When I was asked to do storytelling around our summer theme of Come to the Water, my first thought was about storytelling. And I remembered fondly my father's affection for stories. He would observe that a story, even the one that he had just embellished about his own family, could have more truth in it than anything that had actually happened. Dad taught German and Spanish and literature, so he let his children read Go June. In the 70s, my parents subscribed to Newsweek magazine, which I devoured each week when it arrived. It had stories and pictures. I, along with many others, read the stories about air pollution and saw the pictures of buildings that you could barely make out through the smog. I saw the pictures and stories of Cleveland's Cuyahoga River on fire. I became one of those kids who bugged their parents to start recycling. My church, like the President Richard Nixon, who signed the Clean Air Act, was open to the climate of the times. The other aspect of coming to the water that I couldn't quite resist is that in the last few years, I've changed the focus of my research at work. And boy, this children's time was just like the perfect intro to this. So one project I've been doing recently uses data from NASA satellites, which are literally attracted by the gravitational force of water. So in the case of the Lake Pua, was it? Pua? You can see the water disappear. But the thing about gravity is that it doesn't matter if you can see the water or if it's below ground, it's still exerting a gravitational force on satellites which are spinning around the Earth. So there are two satellites. So these NASA satellites are literally attracted by the gravitational force of water, and they sense the changes. The two satellites are, appropriately for my talk in church, called GRACE. Very church appropriate. It stands for Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. And in another sense, my recent change of focus is also about coming to the water, changing my orientation. Did any of you see the images from the James Webb Space Telescope this week? Yeah, you could. One way of looking at those is that they're pictures. You could look at those pictures and choose to see only clouds of dust and collections of stars, like ours, grouped into galaxies, like ours. Yawn. Show me something I didn't already know. But I thought you could almost hear a collective ooh and ah coming through the coverage of those pictures. Adam, and by implication Eve, were made by God from dust. Another way to see that is that after the Big Bang, there were almost no atoms besides hydrogen and helium. All the rest of the elements, including carbon, were made from those two elements by fusion and fission within stars. Dust could only exist after stars got going. So we are made from the remains of exploded stars. Cool. Ruth Ann Gardner's son, John, is a project scientist with the James Webb Telescope. Many of us caught our first glimpses of galaxies and planets with our own eyes through Steve Shantz's telescopes that he built and knows where to point. Like Steve, who grew up in Ontario, another Canadian had a thing for stars and galaxies. He would drive his family out into the countryside to look through his telescope. This was the father of Catherine Hayhoe. He was also a Baptist minister, and he told his family that both the Book of Scripture and the Book of Nature witnessed to God. When Catherine was 9, the family moved to Cali, Colombia, where her parents worked at a bilingual school and helped out with a local church. She saw that the people around her had very little, and when disaster struck, they ended up with even less. Heavy rains came, and people lost their homes in mudslides. Droughts came, and subsistence farmers went hungry. Folks had no insurance and received little assistance from the government or other organizations. As usual, there were dire needs among the many poor Jews of Ostropol. Rabbi Israel went to the house of Zalman, a rich man, to ask for money to feed the hungry. Uncle Zalman sighed. What can I say? I have my nephew Herschel to support, and he has a large family. The rabbi went away empty-handed. The next day, a long line of people stretched out from the synagogue, hoping for bread. The rabbi was surprised to see Herschel. Isn't Zalman helping you out? Not a kopeck. The rabbi marched back to confront Uncle Zalman. Again, Uncle Zalman sighed. What can I say? I don't give my own flesh and blood anything. How can you expect me to give to strangers? When Rabbi Israel told Herschel, Herschel sighed. The old miser spends nothing on himself or anyone else. I should do him a favor. Rabbi, lend me 2 rubles. Herschel went to the market and bought 2 battered old silver teaspoons and straightened them out, polished them until he could see himself in their reflections. Catherine decided to study astronomy at university, but a course she took on climate science opened her eyes to the way that climate change would affect the poor, increasing inequality, making it harder for farmers to grow food. She grew up believing Christians should respond to God's love by addressing suffering, people's physical needs and well-being. And that's why she decided to switch to becoming a climate scientist. She moved to Texas for a faculty position and married a Baptist youth minister, only to find out that Baptists didn't necessarily believe these things that she felt were important. And her new husband didn't. They had heart-to-heart talks. Luckily for both of them, it turns out he was open to a new perspective. She was starting to be asked to talk to a variety of groups. She discovered that the facts and scientific evidence didn't get her very far. She had to try something else to help people care. A scholar, Michael Spezio, visited Goshen College a few years ago and said something that has stayed with me, that science is not about truth, it's about corrigibility. Not about truth, but about corrigibility. You do your best research, you come to conclusions, but you remain open to new information, and sometimes that changes the conclusions that you had. I think scientists also use stories to make sense of the world. None of those are really the final word. And yet we need to use them to sort of make sense of what's going on and to understand what's going on around us as best we can. On Friday, Herschel went to Uncle Zalman's house. Zalman opened the door a crack. I'm not giving you any money, Herschel. I'm not asking for any. I just want to borrow your silver serving spoon. Yenta's cousin from Minsk is coming for the Sabbath, and I'm ashamed for her to see how poor we are. Well, okay, but you'd better bring it straight back. On Sunday, Herschel returned and set down the serving spoon, and beside it a small silver teaspoon. What's this, Herschel? Uncle Zalman, while we had your spoon, it gave birth. Rabbi Israel says that if a person borrows a cow from another and the cow gives birth, the calf belongs to the cow's owner and not the one who borrowed it. So here you go. He's crazy, thought Uncle Zalman. But he appreciated having another silver spoon. Uncle Zalman, I have another favor to ask. Anything, Herschel, as long as it isn't no money, but Yenta's aunt and her family are coming from Lemberg, and you don't want them to see how poor you are. The family honor is at stake. Sure, Herschel, you may borrow my serving spoon. The next day, Herschel returned and set down the serving spoon, and beside it, a second, smaller silver teaspoon. Another spoon has been born. How pleased I am to have such an honest nephew. And now, Uncle Zalman, I have a big favor to ask you. Anything, Herschel, as long as it isn't, I know better than to ask you for money. No, Yenta's relatives decided to stay for the Sabbath, and we have no candlesticks. Could we borrow yours? Uncle Zalman paused. His candlesticks were solid silver and a foot tall. I never let those candlesticks out of my sight. If anything should happen to them, don't worry, Uncle, I'll be responsible. And if one gives birth, I'll bring the baby candlestick back with the mother. Well, of course you may borrow them. Just bring them right back after the Sabbath, along with any offspring. When Catherine told her own story to church groups, she found a more receptive audience, and she could connect with them based on shared values. Sometimes we play the Mennonite game, trying to find relatives or acquaintances or college experiences we might have in common with others we meet. We're not the only ones that do this. The first physics research group I joined in Illinois teased one of the other students about being part of the Indian Mafia. Every time the group went to a conference in each different city, Anjum always seemed to have a cousin of her mother or the sister of a friend of her father's or some other auntie to visit or stay with. When Catherine went to speak to the West Texas Rotary, She found that Rotarians proudly display their core values on banners. The four-way test: 1, is it the truth? 2, is it fair to all concerned? 3, will it build goodwill and better friendships? And 4, will it be beneficial to all concerned? And she rearranged her talk on the spot to refer to those tests. Afterwards, a local businessman who she recognized from around town was waiting to talk to her. They had certainly never talked about climate change before. "I never thought too much about this whole global warming thing," he said. Translation: he thought it was a load of BS. But it passed the four-way test. Translation: what choice did he have but to believe her? Of course, most people don't wear their beliefs on their T-shirt. Catherine realized listening to others and finding out what matters to them enabled her to connect about something she cared about deeply. Of course, I'm part of many communities, as are you. With some people, I play the Mennonite game. With others, the bicycling game, or we connect over running or children. As soon as he left Uncle Zalman's house, Herschel took those candlesticks straight to the market, where he pawned them for a great deal of money. Then he went to see Rabbi Israel. "Rabbi, here is a gift from Uncle Zalman for the poor people of Ostropol." The rabbi thanked Herschel effusively. Herschel had kept a few rubles for himself, and he bought a chicken and some challah bread and some fresh vegetables, and his family had a fine Sabbath meal. The Sabbath came and went. Uncle Zalman was expecting Herschel. When nightfall came and he still hadn't showed up, Zalman put on his worn boots and his old patched coat and went out and searched for him. He finally found him talking to the rabbi in the synagogue. "Herschel, where are my candlesticks?" "Oh, Uncle, I couldn't bear to tell you right away, but your candlesticks are no more." "What do you mean, are no more? Were they stolen?" "No, much worse. This morning, Yenta went in to get them, and they were lying on the table, and they were dead." "Dead?" He turned to Rabbi Israel. "Herschel stole my candlesticks. Make him give them back." "The candlesticks died," Rabbi Israel replied. "According to our law, if one person borrows a cow from another and the cow dies of natural causes, the person who borrowed her is not responsible." "What nonsense! A candlestick isn't alive. Make him give them back this instant." But Rabbi Israel replied, "Isn't it also nonsense that a spoon can give birth? You were happy to accept nonsense when you stood to profit. Therefore, you must also accept nonsense when you lose." Uncle Zalman never did recover his candlesticks. But when he died, he was led into heaven based on his one and only good deed, which he hadn't even done willingly. Not a bad deal for two candlesticks. "Yeah, so happy, go 2% fund." Another thing Spezio said was that we are made by the communities we choose to associate with. Shared stories can form part of that bond we feel with those with whom we identify closely. But they can also expand our circle of who we identify with. They can reach across time and space and social distance as well to connect us with other communities. And we know that at a fundamental level, we are all connected with other people and with candlesticks and the rest of creation. Even a satellite 500 kilometers above Earth's surface feels the tug of the unseen water, the rain that fell on my lawn last night.